Chair of the Committee, for order. Sorry about being a couple minutes late. We just got a late run at today. So this is the Judiciary Committee meeting, and thank you for all showing up. We have Senator Kelly with us, the President of the Senate. We have the Rules Chairman, Senator Meyer. So we're pretty heavy on leadership on this side over here. We have Senator Costello to my right, and Senator Wilkowski. And what I'd like for each one of you to do is to introduce your staff that is going to be working on the Judiciary Committee so that, number one, I can recognize them, and then other people know who they might be able to get information to. So, Senator Kelly, do you have a staffer that's going to be following us on this committee?
Oh, there he is back there. I was stuck for an answer. I was going to throw it to Nancy over there from the Judiciary. So.
Joe.
Thank you.
That would be Joe. Hi, Joe.
Welcome, Joe. And Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Christine Marsigan is in the back.
Oh, good.
She'll be joining me to the Judiciary.
Thank you, Christina. Senator Costello?
Thank you, and I'm happy to introduce Juliana Moline, who's standing there. She's my aide to the committee and gets rave reviews for being very friendly, so please stop by and talk to her.
That's good. Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you. I have Sonia Kawasaki, who's just started working with me. She's an attorney and clerked for Supreme Court Justice Winfrey last year.
Good. Thank you. And Senator Caldwell is going to have Jordan Schilling staffing the committee, and he will be my point of contact. Yes, sir, Senator Kelly.
I'd like a redo.
Okay, redo, Senator Kelly.
So, Joe Burns is in the back, and most of you know him. He's a Fairbanksan. He's been my staff for several years, and he'll be covering judiciary issues as well as other things.
And most of us know that our staff generally do not only a yeoman's job and work, but they're quite often smarter than us in some areas, and so we depend upon them heavily, as I certainly do with my staff. So this is be the first meeting of the Judiciary Committee meeting. Thank you. And as you can see, we're going to have the Criminal Justice Commission come before us. But before we do have them come before us, let me talk to you a little bit about what I expect we'll do this year. Certainly, our committee is going to be a tight committee. I have a Resources Committee meeting directly after this, so running over is not going to be an option for us. So when we're done at 3 o'clock, we're done. And so I'm going to try to bring us to a wrap-up point before that. And so because of that, what I'd like to do is I'll commit to you that I won't surprise you with new topics and any surprises, but I'd ask that you do the same with me so that when we do get to our deliberation and committee, we can do that thoughtfully. And I know that sometimes as the end of the session comes, amendments come rushing towards us. The sooner we can get them before us and the sooner that we can have them, the better. And I'm going to start off with an apology because I was hoping to get this PowerPoint to you earlier, and normally it might be my way of getting the committee information before you the day before the committee. It just didn't happen this time. Some of that is the wounded wing problem, that I just wasn't here. Some of it was we asked the commission to do some things way late, so that was a forethought problem, and some of it is just printing time. And so between those three, we just kind of got caught up. But I'll try to start as punctually as we can, and I'll try to get that information to you as soon as we can. Senate Bill 91 went through the legislature, because of Senate Bill 91, many, many questions have come up. And what I'm hoping we can do is answer some of those questions along the way. We can show a body of work that has been very good and very effective, and we can show maybe three or four areas where we could do better. And so what I'm hoping to do today is to let the process work on what's actually happened in the commission, what we expect them to do and bring before us as a body of work, and the lingering questions that we have, I'll try to wrap up with, here's what I think we can do to repair some things. But today is going to be pretty much the commission. We'll have some talk to us from police officers. We'll have a little bit from the victims advocacy group that are on the commission. And then next meeting, we'll talk about some of the implementation issues that came forward. So you're going to hear what the commission was tasked to do by the legislature last year under Senate Bill 91, plus their body of work, and then the implementation problems or successes will come before us. And then the reentry issues are the next thing I'd like to cover. And as we go through those, the looming topic of are we getting better public safety outcomes, what can we do better, are going to rise to the surface. That'd be my plan. So today we have the executive director of the Alaska Judicial Council, who is staffing the commission, the Criminal Justice Commission, Suzanne DiPietro. So Suzanne, if you could come forward. We have two members that are on that commission with us today, Chris Sell and Brenda Stanfill, who will also be given some testimony today. My expectation is to let them go through some of the stuff rather rapidly. Most of us have been aware of it, of the work of the body of the commission. Many of us were here during the debate of Senate Bill 91, but many people who are now tuning in to the Judiciary Committee or who will use this as part of their baseline information need to hear what has happened and what is expected to happen from the commission level, recommendation-wise. So my plan is to let Suzanne DiPietro run through it fairly rapidly, and unless there's a question that on process or something that just needs to be clarified, I'll entertain that, but I'd really like to defer to let them go through the slides. Is that okay with the committee?
Absolutely.
Thank you. So as soon as she gets prepared, Suzanne, thank you for coming. First of all, for the body of work that you have been tasked to do at the Judicial Council and at the Commission, my deepest gratitude. I've witnessed the work firsthand and have been a part of it to what level I can. It's been very deliberative, it's been very thoughtful, and we really laid on you some extra work last year. And I'd like to hear from you not only about the Commission, but how that work has been taken on and what you think will be coming forward on recommendations. So the floor is yours, Suzanne. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Coghill and members of the Judiciary Committee. Thanks for having me here today to talk a little bit about the Criminal Justice Commission and its work. So the slide deck that I have here is actually quite dense. There's quite a bit of text. I'm not going to be reading those slides. I provided them to you really for background information. I'm going to give you an overview. So I first want to just remind folks about the establishment of the commission, which was in 2014 by Senate Bill 64, and then the commission's term was actually extended in 91, in Senate Bill 91, and some additional duties were added, and I'm going to talk about some of those additional duties. So when the commission was created, the legislature asked the Judicial Council to staff the commission and provided our staff attorney, Barbara Dunham, who is here, and we also have a part-time research analyst, Stacey Corey, who is in Anchorage. And along those lines, I also wanted to mention, I should have just a minute ago, that we have several commissioners here in the room, Commissioner Williams, Commissioner Jesse, in addition to the ones who were introduced before. So I just wanted to let you know that there are several commissioners here. The commissioners have been very engaged in the process.
And just for the record, I've been on the commission as one of the commission members. We'll see if how the appointment goes this go around.
Right. So my second slide already has a typo. 13 members, not voting members. We have 11 voting members and two non-voting members, Senator Coghill being one of those. So there are governor's appointees, Lieutenant Chris Sell and Brenda Stanfill, both of whom are here today. Member of the Alaska Native community, that's Greg Razzo. He's our chair, and he is at SERI. Also, we have Jeff Jesse of the Mental Health Trust. The Chief Justice appoints three members of the commission, and those are three judges. We've got a retired Justice Alex Brenner, District Court Judge Stephanie Rhodes, and Superior Court Judge Trevor Stevens. Continuing on with the membership, the state agency commissioners on the commission are John Lindemuth, our Attorney General, Dean Williams, who's here, Walt Monaghan, who I also believe is here in the room, and Quinlan Steiner, the public defender, all of whom I think you're well familiar with. And then the two legislative appointees who are non-voting, Senator Coghill, as I mentioned, and also Representative Klayman, and he is our newest commission member, and he was just appointed last week. So these next two slides are really a citation directly from the statute that tells the commission what to do. And I just want to, I'm not going to go through all the dense verbiage here, but I wanted you to get an idea of the authorizing statute and the direction that was given to the commission by the legislature and the direction that the commission takes very seriously. So the first sort of, I'm going to try to sort of summarize. The first sort of area of responsibility that the commission was tasked with in this statute is to take a look at not just our laws but our practices in the criminal justice system and try to evaluate how are they working. Is the state of Alaska getting the value? Is it getting the results that we want as a state out of our criminal justice system? And in doing that, the commission has to consider a number of factors that you so intelligently put in here. There are many, many factors to consider, including all the factors that we usually take into account in sentencing. For example, protection of the public, community condemnation of offenders, the rights of the accused, restitution, rehabilitation. I mean, these are all important factors in the criminal justice system, and some of them work together and some of them work in tension. And so this is what the commission is tasked with, and it takes that responsibility very seriously. The second general area of responsibility I would categorize as data collection and analysis. And so the commission really is in a unique position to consider empirical information about how the system is working or not working, to consider studies from other places and from Alaska itself about what are the most effective things that we can do in the criminal justice system. And I'm here to tell you, having done now a lot of that research, some of the things that we intuitively think might be effective end up being not effective, and some of the things we think would not be effective end up being, again, from an empirical perspective, shown by studies to be effective at rehabilitating offenders. And so that's something I think that has given a lot of value to the commission and that the commission has embraced, that it wants to be data-driven and it wants to be making its decisions based as much as possible on information about what is actually happening on the ground, what actually has been proven to work, and what actually has been proven not to work. There was a third special charge that the legislature gave the commission, and that's not in the statute, but it came from legislative leadership in 2015, and that was a letter asking the commission, as it formulated its recommendations, to try to do one of three things, or maybe all three things. First, to develop recommendations that might avert all future prison growth. That would be the large goal, I guess. The second suggestion was that the commission develop recommendations to avert all future prison growth and reduce the current prison population by 15%. And then building on that, could the commission come up with recommendations that would avert all future prison growth and reduce the current prison population by 25%? Those are big goals, and the commission took them very much to heart. And so adding to the mix of things that the commission has been directed to do and that the commission has thought very hard about and worked very hard on is, can prison growth be controlled while public safety is protected? And so that's been a big part of the discussion at the commission. I want to talk a little bit about how the commission works. Those of you who haven't been to the meetings might just want to have a little background on that. So the commission, although the statute said that it needed to meet at least quarterly, it has met more often than that, really, from the beginning. So at the very beginning, I would characterize the work pace as a sprint. And the commission was meeting every month, and it established working groups to deal with particularly technical aspects of proposals. Those were meeting one or two times in between commission meetings. And that was an enormous volume of work and study, and really got all the commissioners well grounded in the empirical information and the data and understanding the problems that we're facing the state. I mentioned the working groups. I'll talk a little bit about those later. I think one of the most important decisions that the Commission made at the very beginning of its process was that it agreed to make decisions based on evidence, data, and empirical information, and to limit reliance on anecdotes or other less reliable information. And that is an important charge, and the Commission has tried to be quite true to that. So these next slides also contain information about what the Commission has been directed to consider when it makes its recommendations. Again, I'm not going to read all these, but I put them there to give you the flavor of all the factors that the Commission is considering when it's making its recommendation and doing its studies. And again, these are things that some of these factors work with each other in the same direction. Some of these factors go in the other direction. There's tension within the criminal justice process. There's tension within criminal sentencing law. We have a variety of objectives and goals that we're trying to achieve. For example, we want to rehabilitate the offender. We also want to have victims be heard. We want the offenders to be able to pay restitution and to be able to try to make the community whole for the harm that they've caused. We also want to express community condemnation of their conduct. So these are factors that can all work together, but they can also be a little bit in tension. And those are the complex considerations that the Commission is struggling with. I want to just highlight this one other part of the statute that the Commission, you've told the Commission and has taken very seriously, to solicit information, obtain views from a variety of constituencies so that it can get the best possible spectrum of approaches. And I want to talk a little bit about how the Commission has worked on this. It has in terms of engaging the public, the Commission publishes all its meeting schedules on its website and in the online notice system. The Commission has developed email lists of people who want to be sent emails notifying about meetings and agendas and so forth. It also has reached out to stakeholders. So there's, in my mind, I think of sort of the general public and then individual stakeholders, for example, agency representations. The Commission has actively solicited the participation of subject matter experts, for example, from the agencies, from municipal government, from nonprofits, from a lot of different stakeholder areas that act in the area of criminal justice. And at every meeting, there's a public comment period, and the Commission receives public comment, and anyone can send a letter at any time with anything to the Commission staff, and we bring it to the Commission's attention. So I want to be sure that you understand that the Commission has done a very strong job reaching out, and particularly, I'm particularly proud of the work that the Commission did in 2014 and 15, reaching out to victims groups. It had a variety of victims roundtables. It brought in Ann Seymour, who is a national victims rights expert, and she came and wrote a report summarizing for the Commission what are the views and wants and needs of victims in this state. The Commission also has made a huge emphasis on getting input from rural areas. So the Commission actually had a meeting up in the 2nd Judicial District in Nome. The Commission also has sent representatives to, at the invitation of Commissioner Valerie Davidson, to the YK Delta, to small communities within the YK Delta. So the Commission has done what it can, given budget constraints on travel and so forth, to reach out to the rural areas. There are some more factors that the legislature told the Commission to consider, and these a little bit mirror some of the things I've talked about before. I throw them up there for you to see the sort of the complex level of analysis that that the legislature has tasked the Commission with and that the Commission takes very seriously. So now I want to talk a little bit about challenges, bring it down a little bit from the statute and put it a little bit, situate it a little bit into our real life situation. So one of the first things that the Commission learned in its data analysis, and I think many of you know this, I say it again just for folks who might be new to the discussion, is is that Alaska has a not very good success rate for folks who go into prison, that they return, many of them between 58% and 66%, depending on the study you look at, actually return to prison either for a new crime or for some other reason within 3 years. And actually most of those folks return within the first 6 months of being released. And I think I personally can say that I think that we can do better than that. We should do better than that. And that is one of the motivating factors for the commission, is a 66% recidivism rate. Alaska can do better. Commission's also learning through its stakeholder involvement that in general community treatment resources and violence prevention programs were not available for many of the people who need them, and that would be many of the offenders who need them. Commission also is well aware of the corrections growth in the state of Alaska, and it's not the only thing that the commission looked at, but it's one of the things. And, you know, the prison population grew by 27% in the last decade, and that's a lot faster than the resident population, 3 times faster. So it's unexpected, that rate of growth. And at that rate of growth, we would have exceeded our capacity, our current prison capacity, by this year. The commission also learned, and this is related to the previous point, that Alaska may have been, actually the commission really, I think it's fair to say, that Alaska, through practice and partially through statute, really was over-relying on prison as a response to crime. Not that we shouldn't rely on prison, but how much do we rely on prison? So the commission learned that 3/4 of offenders entering prison to serve a sentence in 2014 had been convicted of a nonviolent offense, like a property offense. The length of stay for sentenced felony offenders had risen 31% over the past decade. And 28% of prison beds in 2014 were occupied by pretrial detainees. Those are people who have not yet been convicted of a crime. So we're really relying on prison a lot to sort of hang on to people that we don't know what else to do with. The commission also learned, again, through reliance on, you know, studies from other places, empirical information, that longer prison stays do not reduce recidivism more than shorter prison stays. So there's a diminishing, longer prison stays do not reduce recidivism any more than shorter prison stays. And that might seem a little counterintuitive. You might think that keeping a person in prison longer will teach him a better lesson and cause him to really want to not offend when he comes out. And actually, that just isn't the case. There's a point of diminishing returns when you're just keeping people in prison at some expense, but you're not getting any benefit for that when they come out. They're still having that failure rate, that terrible 2/3 failure rate. That's something that we want to get away from. So that seemed like a problem. The other thing that the commission learned is that about 60% of offenders on probation and parole, so those are people who've been convicted and who've served a sentence and who are coming out on supervision, those people, about 60% of them return to prison within 3 months of release. In other words, they're failing pretty much right off the bat. And again, this goes back to the idea that surely we can do better than that. So now I want to talk to you a little bit about what the commission has provided to you.
Suzanne, if I can just interject you. I just wanted to let people know that we have a couple of legislators in the room. So we have Senator Hughes has joined us, and Representative Ryan Bolden, I think. Yeah, I didn't miss anybody. Oh, and the majority leader, Senator Machicki. Excuse me, sir. Anyway, I just wanted you to know that this has generated some interest, and so as we get into commission products, you know, what are we going to do about that is one of the big questions that has been looming over us, and so we'll be looking at this with great interest.
Great.
So thank you.
Thank you. So I also might just pause here and ask the panel if there are any questions or comments.
Senator Wolkowski.
I whizzed through it pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. So going back a slide.
Yeah.
During the debate, there was a lot of discussion about this nonviolent offender number, and it's pretty startling. 75% of people in the prison system are nonviolent offenders. The recidivism rates, but now what we're hearing from police and from constituents is that people are committing these property crimes and there's just nothing happening to them. They're not being put in jail. There's not a lot, and the police are concerned that there's just not a lot of action that they can take. And have you experienced that? Do you care to address that at this point?
So the commission actually just had a meeting at which it had excellent public testimony from a number of law enforcement officers and has heard those concerns, and also from a municipal prosecutors. And actually, it was an excellent discussion. It's a little bit complicated. I don't know if I want to go into it too much here, but there's two separate issues. There's the issue of whether a person should be held pretrial, and then what the sentence will be. And so I think part of the concern is that when people are arrested, it has been our practice in this state, 28%, remember, 28% of all jail beds were occupied by people who hadn't been convicted, who had just been charged, arrested, taken to jail, and couldn't bail out. So there has been a reliance, I think, in this state on using the pretrial process as a way to detain people. And some of the and that was part of the challenge for the commission to consider whether that is a good use of prison beds. So there's the whole issue of when the officer decides to cite, either to issue the person a summons to come to court later or arrest them and physically take them to jail, whether they stay in jail or whether they can make bail or be released. So there's that first issue of, if they go to jail, will they be released immediately or will they be held until their case is resolved? So the commission learned that around 50% of all people who were arrested and taken to jail and charged with a crime were actually held the entire time before their case was resolved. So they stayed. And so that is why 28% of the beds were being taken up by people who were pretrial, and the legislation, I don't want to go too far into it, had a solution to that, which is being implemented. The second issue is about whether a person should receive jail time as a part of their sanction, and that goes back, I think, to what I was talking about with the over-reliance on prison. So, again, I don't want to get too much detail on the statistics, but in 2014, there were over 300 people, I'm not going to say the exact number because I'm not sure of it, who were serving a sentence for stealing something worth less than $250. 93% of those cases were shoplifting cases. Most of the things they stole were toiletries and alcohol. And those people were spending an average of 23 days in jail. So that would be like stealing a bottle of mouthwash and on average going to jail for 23 days. Now, without talking about community condemnation or what that might feel like, that person did that and harmed the person who owned the store owner by taking that, I think that was the information that the commission had in terms of what are we using our jail resources on, what are we using our prison bed resources on, and finding that these people who are committing among the smallest of thefts were spending significant amounts of time. So that is an example of how the commission dealt with the evidence.
So, Senator Wilkowski, what you hit upon is a very strong issue that we're going to have to deal with. There was also one other complicating factor, and that was the court system implementing a bail schedule that released people on their own recognizance kind of simultaneously to the bill coming into effect. And there are probably three areas that I'll want us to look at and deal with. One of them is the bail schedule. One of them is the escalating factor of petty theft or smaller theft crimes. And then we're going to look at some of the jail sentencing issues that surrounded the felony theft level at sea level. I think we'll look at those three areas to see if there's public safety tools we can look at. That's kind of the public condemnation coming our way. But I wanted the commission to put forward the best foot they could on the empirical data that they could come up with, research-based. And so we certainly have heard from a public, there's too many people bouncing out of jail way too fast, and they're scoffing at the law, and this is not acceptable. Mm-hmm. And I agree with that. then it's a matter of what can we do better about it, knowing that this whole body of law is working fairly well. It's just that that area has just hit us hard. And so we'll be dealing with that as we move forward. I'm hoping to come out of this meeting and the next two meetings with some recommendations on, and one, that will be one of the strong areas, Senator.
Just if I could just ask another question on a similar issue, but because I've also, of course, heard the concerns that crime is up, violent crime is up in Anchorage in particular, mm-hmm. and people are scared. People mm-hmm. are concerned that mm-hmm. it's because of this bill that we passed. Mm-hmm. And so can you maybe just refresh us on the portions of the bill that went into effect and when they went into effect mm-hmm. to the best of your memory.
Sure.
And then tell the public. I mean, I think we should be upfront with them. If we need to make changes to the bill, we should do that. But at the same time, if there's a misperception, I think we owe it to correct that misperception. So mm-hmm. If Mr. Chair, if it's okay, if you could just... The bill has only been in effect for 6 months or so. So in your opinion, do you have any empirical data or any information that would lead you to believe that it's contributing to the uptick in crime in Anchorage or in Alaska as a whole?
So thank you, Senator Wildkowski. So the connection between – so the issue of the crime rate and the connection between that and how the criminal justice system acts is not as straightforward as you might think. The crime rate is affected by a lot of factors. It's affected by the number of police. It's affected by the number of arrests. It's affected by the heroin epidemic. It's affected by the economy. So there are a lot of things that affect the crime rate, but what I can say for sure, and actually because the commission is concerned about this issue of rising crime, the commission is working on a memo that should be ready within a couple of weeks, hopefully, I'll say that. Taking a 30-year look back on the crime rate in Alaska, but also in Anchorage, and it's quite interesting. The uptick in crime began 2 to 3 years ago. So it is true that there's been an uptick. Interestingly, there have been times in the past when the crime rate has been higher than it is now, quite a bit higher. So you take that 30-year look back, and it's very interesting to do that. But putting that aside, people are concerned. And but for sure, this uptick in crime was already occurring. I mean, before the commission was even created. So we'll have more details on that. I don't want to say too many numbers because I don't want to get it wrong. But so it is a real issue that the crime rate is ticking up. It's not as high as it has been in the past. In some areas, it is. And it's something that the commission wants to look at. But the bill, to answer your question, so the bill is kind of in three parts. The first part that went into effect in around July of last year had to do with many of the penalties for crimes, so the sentences that were going to be given. The part that went into effect in January has to do with the use, with the changes to the way people on probation are supervised. People on felony probation are supervised. Changes to the parole system and the probation system. Those just went into effect in January, and the Department of Corrections, I imagine that Commissioner Williams will tell you about it, has been working so hard to improve. Because remember I mentioned that statistic, 60% of people who were on supervision were failing. Pretty quickly. That's a statistic that the criminal justice reform really aims to take a whack at. And so there's been a lot of work done by the Department of Corrections with technical assistance and on their own to really improve the whole probation process. And that just went into effect in January. And then the third part, which hasn't even gone into effect yet, has to do with the pretrial release provisions. So one of the things that I'm hearing that people are confused about because of the bail schedule, which is something that the presiding judges of the court system put into effect and actually really was not had really nothing, it just wasn't part of the bill. Criminal justice reform, the idea is that in 2018, so in about another year, we will have changes to our pretrial process, important changes. Again, remember that 28% of beds was taken up by people who hadn't even been convicted yet. Some of those people could probably have been safely released. We didn't have a good way of telling who could be safely released and who really should stay. Who could be safely released if they were monitored for example. So that is what is coming into effect in 2018, is that we will have a tool that will help the attorneys and the judges decide, make a better decision about, hopefully a better decision about, who can safely be released while they're waiting for their case to be resolved. And when I say safely, I mean hopefully that they are at low risk of committing a new offense while they're out, and that they also will appear for their court case. And those people who can be released with supervision or not should be released to relieve the pressure on the prisons if that can be done safely. And the ones who can't should be held. So that's not even coming into effect until 2018. And again, Department of Corrections and the Commissioner are working really hard to implement that piece of it.
And we'll be having them in front of us. Timeline issues are a big question on implementation mm-hmm. in several areas
mm-hmm.
Between Department of Correction, what the Department of Law is doing.
Yeah.
So we'll have the departments in front of us as well, talking about both the process and the challenges and the successes.
I'm really personally excited about some of the changes to probation and parole supervision practices. I think that could have a big impact on folks coming out and their success rate, and also the reentry coalitions. So just real quickly, I've taken up maybe a little too much time. I tend to get a little too technical sometimes. So I wanted to remind the panel that the legislature directed the commission to submit a report on alcohol-related offenses in Title 28, and those are the DUI and refusal-type offenses. The commission submitted that report to you. I believe you have it in your packet. It's a little bit thick and technical, but I think you'll find it to be a great resource for understanding. So the commission did a lot of work sort of understanding, hey, what is happening with DUI and refusal now? What do the studies show is effective? What do the studies show is not effective? And it has some recommendations for your consideration.
And we'll be looking at those, even though I think there's a Title IV reform coming our way.
Yeah.
The Title 28 issue, we can at least bring in broad terms here in this committee.
Mm-hmm. The legislature also directed the commission to make a report on restitution, and actually restitution was something the commission was working on even before it was directed to by this body. And one of the things the commission cares very deeply about is how to improve restitution collection for victims, and how offenders can be held accountable in the sense of trying to restore or diminish the harm that they cause to the community and to the victim by their offenses. This is a very important concept, restorative justice. I think you may be familiar with it, but the commission is very interested in the concept of restorative justice, and it's something that's a very powerful concept. And again, it may be in this state that we've relied maybe a lot on incarceration as a response to crime, and that is certainly appropriate. But there is another way that offenders can be held accountable, and that's to make, I mean, an offense, you know, rends the fabric of the community. It not only hurts individual victims, but it hurts the community as a whole. And whatever offenders can do to repair as best they can some of that damage, I think is very important and actually contributes to their rehabilitation and hopefully contributes to their not committing offenses in the future. So that's a report that the commission submitted to you, and it's going to be, the commission will be doing more work on the restorative justice area going forward. You also asked the commission to send a report on social impact bonds, the potential of using them to reduce recidivism rates, and that report should be in your packet. There have not been instances of social impact bonds being used in Alaska. They have been used in other places, and the commission tried to take a look at how they're working. It's kind of a new concept, not super well proven yet, but with lots of potential. And so the commission tried to sort of sort through what is the potential and what is the actual track record of use of social impact bonds. The commission also submitted its annual report, as it's required to do, and that is not very long and has a pretty good summary of what the commission's been up to, so you might take a look at that.
And we put them in your packets, and it is pretty intense reading, but for this committee, I think we need to go through the technical stuff while we deal with kind of the the concerns that are coming to us from the public. So it's both the technical and the big policy calls.
And then I also just wanted to give you a couple of categories of work that the commission had done that was within the statute but not necessarily special reports requested by the legislature. So the commission is really recognizing the connection between behavioral health issues and criminal offending. By one count, around 65% of folks involved in the criminal justice system are beneficiaries of the mental health trust, meaning they have either a substance abuse disorder or a mental health disorder. So that's a very strong connection, correlation there between those two issues. And so the commission has formed a behavioral health committee that's looking at how can the behavioral health system and the criminal justice system work together better to reduce recidivism. And one of the, I just gave you a couple of examples of recommendations there that the commission has forwarded to you for your consideration. I also wanted to let you know that the commission's been doing a very extensive review of our sentencing structure, our presumptive sentencing structure that we have in Alaska. And the commission has forwarded to you a proposal for a mitigator that would allow prosecutors, defense attorneys, and victims hopefully to get cases resolved more timely. So the full text of the recommendation, we can send that to you if it's not handy, but that is something that I just wanted to bring to your attention.
Well, as we move forward, I think the commission is meeting to finalize some recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'd like to do is probably have a full list of recommendations as a final report.
Okay.
To the legislature. And we'll get into those within the next week or so. But at this point, I know you're still under deliberation on some of those.
That's right. So just talking about future work, the legislature has asked the commission to submit a report on sex-related offenses, and it has formed a work group and is working on that. I don't have a timeline on that because it's a very complex topic, but that is in process. The commission is also directed to oversee the implementation of the statutory changes in criminal justice reform, and it is doing that. We are in the process of collecting data and analyzing data. And that is that's a big task, but something that we're very excited about. And then in terms of immediate next steps, as I mentioned before, the commission had a meeting last week, and it heard a lot of testimony from law enforcement and prosecutors, concerns about the three areas that the Senator Coghill mentioned and that Senator Wielkowski mentioned. And so the commission heard that feedback. It also had an extensive, lengthy discussion about the bail schedule, the court system's bail schedule. And in an effort to sort of take a look at some of those concerns and see if it could come up with recommendations, it had a discussion, ran out of time, and set another meeting for actually this Friday. And so it is my hope that, I know that the commission will be working through the list of ideas to respond to some of the concerns that have been heard, and it is my hope that the commission can get through that list on Friday. And we will see if they are able to do that. That's all I had prepared, yeah.
And you went through a pretty dense
yes.
body quickly. So any further questions or comments? What I do, we have 45 minutes, 40 minutes, and I have Commissioner Christel, who's also with the commission, and with the Juneau Police Department, who can come up. And why don't I have her come on up and prepare to give her testimony. And come on in, Chris, and have a seat. Suzanne, you can be excused unless there's further questions, and I can always ask her to come back up. Both Commissioner Stahl and Commissioner Stanfill will give us some testimony today, and I wanted to give them ample time and then allow you some questions if you so choose. And you can see, Commissioner, that we've already been alerted to at least three major areas that we're going to have to look at, as well as the commission looking at. But it's nice to have somebody like you that has not only have to work with the law enforcement community, but really sees on a day-to-day basis the faces of the people who are either habitual or continual offenders and who will change or who won't change.
Right.
And so you have probably one of the better views that we will be anticipating some of your responses on. and some of your testimony. So put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Sure. My name is Chris Sell. I'm a commissioner on the Criminal Justice Commission. I have been so since the beginning. My job is that I'm a lieutenant at the Juneau Police Department. I do not speak for the entirety of the Juneau Police Department. As a matter of fact, some people have asked me what was I thinking. So we'll get into that. But I did join the Criminal Justice Commission at the very start, and I joined with a burning desire to be tough on crime. And I was going to keep bad people in jail, and I told the chief, here, hold my coat, I'm going to Anchorage. And that was my commitment, and it's been my commitment throughout my law enforcement career, is that I want people that are hurting other people to be in jail, and I want us to be safe walking our streets. So I joined the Criminal Justice Commission, and I kind of sat through the first year of meetings with my arms mentally crossed over my chest and occasionally snarling at Quinlan Steiner, who's the defense attorney, faced off with a couple of other commissioners. So when Suzanne says there's tension in our criminal justice system, we saw that played out in that room. And so while we were being exposed to a lot of education, I didn't want to hear it. I did not want to hear it for a long time. And because it made me confront some of my secret theories that I think a lot of us have that we don't trot out there about how we think criminals behave. And like that secret theory that if we put somebody in jail for a certain number of days correlated to a certain crime, whether that's 13 days or 53 days or 147 days, that's when they have this epiphany. And maybe they even jump up in the cafeteria of the prison and say, I'm not going to be a criminal anymore. I get it. Now I just get it. I mean, that's how many days it took, and now I got it. But having actually been in the prison and been lodging people in the prison, it's more like they're playing cards and watching TV and having conversations about how to get away with more crime rather than a lot of soul-searching and epiphanies. That's not happening. We want that to happen. We want them to think, if we hit this sweet spot for this particular crime, then they'll come out all better, and we won't have to worry about this person hurting anyone. But the science doesn't bear that out. And the science doesn't bear out my personal experiences when I would keep arresting the same people over and over again. And I'm thinking, man, you just must be really stubborn or not very bright or something, because you keep committing crimes and you keep going to prison and you just don't get it. And that was a really comforting way to look at it, because it's got a simple solution. Put them back in jail and see if they get it this time. But I had to eventually let in the information that the fact they're still a drug addict probably has a lot to do with why they're continuing to commit crimes. Or perhaps the fact that they're mentally ill and that's untreated and they're self-medicating with drugs is the reason that we're pulling them out of more and more derelict situations. So I had to start letting the information in, as uncomfortable as it was, and it was not a lot of fun. But I had to come to a place in my own reasoning that I realized that what I was thinking was tough on crime was actually just being tough on people and refusing to treat the reasons that they were committing the crimes. And that when you're just being tough on the people that are committing crimes, it makes it really easy for them to just go out and commit more crimes. They have their underlying cause for why they're committing crimes unaddressed. Now, I grew up in a household that was probably not the most progressive when it came to child discipline. So when I made a mistake, my parents were very clear, I don't care why you did it. I don't care what you were thinking. You did it, and here's the punishment. And I think in large part, we've been addressing our criminal population that same way. I don't care why you did it. You did it, and here's what's going to happen to you. The problem is that didn't work out very well for us, because when we never got into why'd you do it, you know, is it a drug habit? Are you mentally ill? Is there something else going on? We didn't change what had them committing the crime, so we throw them back into the same environment with the same temptations, and then we're surprised when they do the same thing that they were doing before, when actually, as we've seen, more likely than not, that's what people are going to do. When you take the person with the same problems, unaddressed, and throw them right back into the same environment you pulled them out of. So I had to really change my mind about a lot of things, and it was very painful. So far, I've held off the facial tick, but we're not done yet. So we'll see when the Criminal Justice Commission closes. But it was some brutally hard work, and I spent a lot of time resisting the information, and I was unhappy about what I was hearing about shortening punishment, and I was offended by less probation. But I had to look at the truth that I could see that, like, let's say you pull someone out of their own life for 30 days, that's a friction point. That's long enough to lose your job, lose your housing, lose a lot of the things that cause you to want to be something other than a criminal. And so you get a consequence that sinks in, right, with incarcerations. And I've developed a new vision. And this new vision was, okay, as soon as somebody gets arrested, as soon as they get in trouble, what if we could crawl right into the center of their lives and really look at it? Why'd they do it? What was behind it? What was their motivator? What does it take to change that motivator? And then relentlessly supervise that once we knew about it. When we start answering the question, why did this happen, and then start putting those things in place like drug testing and required employment and supervision, wouldn't we do a better job if we actually treated the situation and were tough on crime by rehabilitating the person from being a criminal so they didn't go out and just keep racking up victim after victim after victim while nothing really changed for them? So I think that's a great vision. I think a lot of reasonable people would agree with that. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, when you go in to see a doctor, that's kind of what they do. They look at the totality. So if we start doing that with criminals and then do all this supervision, that's great. But that kind of supervision and drug treatment and mental health, the checks and supervising how people are doing with their treatment, that costs money. So what do you do when you need this thing that costs money? Our budgets are just getting smaller, and the pressure on the money is just getting greater every day. So you try and save some hard beds at $150 a night, which is hotel rates, so that you can afford those things that may actually change the behavior that we need, so that we know we need all of the drug treatment and all of the mental health treatment. How do we get to that money? And we've got a gap here. We put some things in place to save money, and we have some things that aren't in place yet, like intensive pretrial services, that person that's really crawling into their lives and figuring out what's going on. And it's a rough time. It's you know, we don't have some of the things in place we needed. And so there are some things that implementation-wise did not work out the way we envisioned. The 18 months suspended for a C felony, that's one of the things my coworker said. What could you possibly have thinking? I mean, had you not slept in days? What was going on with you? And how that was imagined is most officers know felons who will say, you know what, I'm just going to flat time my time in prison, because when I get out, I don't want to be drug tested. I don't want to have it supervised who I'm hanging out with. I don't want to be checking with a probation officer. So I'm going to flat time it, because it's more comfortable to get out and then have all that access to the freedoms and temptations that they want. But if you have an intensive supervision, that's more punishing than playing cards and watching TV in prison, hanging out with friends there. So what we imagined is that, okay, now that someone's starting to enter this felony range and we can hang 18 months over their head, can we make that really effective? Can we really hold that person accountable, not for just putting them in prison, but accountable for their behavior when they're outside the jail? Because that's what counts, is what they're doing when you and I are passing them on the street, not what they're doing when they're just sitting in the prison at $150 a day, which is the same cost as putting them up in a hotel. So that's a significant cost. Now, you will hear, and it's true, that drug and alcohol treatment is expensive. It is expensive. But I think that when you look at the cost of not doing it, when you have multiple incarcerations, and if you have a heroin addict that's stealing property between $400 and $1,000 a day to feed a habit, that's expensive. It's just you put the expense into the tools they're taking out of somebody's garage, instead of into a system that will address their addiction. So it's going to get paid for somewhere. It's a matter of where do you want that person to be paid for, because it is an expensive problem. So the Criminal Justice Commission has done some really hard work, much harder work than I ever thought I would be doing when the governor's office called and I answered the phone. And whoever nominated me for the commission has not owned up to that yet, so maybe down the road. But we did some really painful work, and it's always been my intent to be tough on crime. I think we owe that to our communities, but we need to resist the emotional satisfaction of believing that being tough on people is the same thing.
Chris, thank you very much. I think many of us have felt that very same journey, and we have heard probably very in great volume that the tools used for the petty theft have not worked because of the release on the own recognizance, mm-hmm. and the inability to hold them even for a judge to see them.
Right.
And I think we have to address that. So along the way, I have a feeling that as we percolate up the discussion, we'll see how the C-felony time works, or whatever tools we can use for the police to have somebody who just doesn't bounce out back out and really becomes a scofflaw.
Right.
Because that's not really holding them accountable either.
No, it is not. And there are certainly things we need to address. One of the implementation things that I didn't see coming was violating conditions of release. We turned that into a violation, saying, okay, then the judge will open the underlying case and will address things like bail in conditions in the underlying case. That's just going to open the door. And then when we started doing that, judges said, well, I don't have the authority to open the underlying case. And as a police officer, I never thought I would hear judges say they didn't have authority for something. So I was floored when that happened. And that was an operational issue that we didn't see coming, that caught us off guard. And we knew that when we put our recommendations out there that it wasn't going to be perfect. Maybe in your political experience, you've turned out a lot of perfect things that never needed adjustment. But from what I've observed, you know, sometimes you've got to make changes, because a lot of the information was from what happened in other states. It was good science, but that doesn't mean it's going to be exactly the same here. And there are so many moving parts to adjust to. So we've had that conversation. I don't think anybody on the commission is offended by talking about some changes. I mean, we still want to keep the vision intact. We still want to have safe communities with effective incarceration and criminal justice. But we're trying to find the right place to navigate through that.
I, for one, appreciate the view that you've had. And I really appreciate what you said about the tough on crime over tough on people. And I think accountability is what I would say.
Absolutely.
People need to be held accountable for why they're violating people or violating the law. And so I think that accountability is pretty much, we were saying the same thing, but you said it better than I did. And
refusing to provide treatment for a drug addict is encouragement of crime.
Yeah.
It's not being tough on crime.
Questions? Senator Pastel?
Thank you, and Mr. Chair. I appreciate you having this hearing, and I also wanted to mention that I really appreciate the response that I've gotten from Suzanne DiPietro. She, along with the mayor of Anchorage, the head of the crime unit for the Anchorage Police Department, the director of the Alaska State Troopers, and the deputy commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, a member of Recovery Alaska, and also the UAA Justice Center, all participated in a round table in my community at my invitation. And I just want to say that there's been tremendous concern in the community about Senate Bill 91. And having you here today is a really great opportunity for me to just ask one question that I received in a neighborhood, social media opportunity, which was for people to discuss what's going on in our community. And, you know, my neighbors are having their homes broken into. We are seeing a lot more crime, or hearing about it, in Anchorage. And one of the comments on that social media site was that the police no longer have the options that they had prior to this bill, and that we as legislators somehow impacted the decisions that are made when a police officer comes in contact with a criminal. And I was wondering if you could clear up that one myth. And I know I have a lot of questions, you know, to ask, but I don't want to take up too much time now. But I think it's important to bring this issue down to the residence level, to the Alaskan who, when we go to bed at night, we're locking our doors because we're concerned about our safety and our family safety. And I think that it's very important as lawmakers that we look at what we've done and say, where do we get it right and where can we make improvements? And so I think that's something that I can't let you leave without answering the question about do the police have the tools to still do your job, and have we in any way affected your interaction, personal interaction with an Alaskan who's been victimized, and you're looking at what to do with the perpetrator?
Well, it's hard to answer for everyone, and each situation is different. So that's a difficult situation. We have had some frustration with things like no jail time for the first C felony. It's suspended, so something else would have to happen to give them jail time. So we have had officers who have said things in the field like, even if I had this person here who did this C felony, they wouldn't get any jail time, so I probably wouldn't arrest them. And there's a lot of interplays that happen, because that has to do with the prosecution and, you know, how long, you know, could they get any jail time. So, I mean... There's impacts that are kind of a response to the bill. There's interplay with other things like less prosecution. District attorney's offices don't have the funding they need to do to prosecute. We have a bail schedule that suggests OR release for all misdemeanor crimes unless you call. There are other considerations when you contact a suspect. One of the developments that have come up is Department of Corrections has had to address all of their in-custody deaths. And one of the ways they've tried to manage that risk is to not take into custody people that are extremely drunk. Well, extremely drunk people are often the people who commit crimes. And so officers are newly in the position of having decided, do I have enough resources to have two officers sit on this person at the hospital until they're sober enough to even get them into jail, or am I not going to arrest them now or cite them into court or do something else than arrest them and tie up those resources? So I don't know if you read the Attorney General's op-ed piece that she wrote. It was very good, but there's a lot of things going on in the same environment and at the same time as Senate Bill 91, and several of those things contribute to frustration at the law enforcement level. Now, each particular case would be different as far as what exactly was going on there. And the times before that we didn't arrest people right away, like they needed medical care, and we don't want that bill, so we're going to file charges on them and address it later. There's a whole bunch of things that can be going on, including a frustration that you don't feel like this person is going to get real punishment because they're not going to prison, and that can change an emotional response in the field. So that is an extraordinarily complicated question, and depending on exactly the scenario they were talking about, you know, what exactly did the suspect do? Were they very intoxicated? Were they injured? Did you have them on the scene? What was your resources to deal with it that night? What was the conversation between the prosecutor and the officer if they called the prosecutor from the field? And all of those things can come into play on a case. So it's very difficult to, without knowing that exact scenario, in talking to the people to involve, to know why was that decision made.
Ms.
So what we can do, Commissioner, first of all, thank you for coming for the committee, and I've invited you to be here for next Wednesday. We can continue this dialogue. But what did happen with Senate Bill 91 is the level of frustration has risen, and there's a place to point to.
Right.
And so what I think we can take seriously at this committee is what can we do to help answer some of those frustrations?
Absolutely.
And certainly, what did we do in Senate Bill 91 that wasn't congruent to what our goal was?
Mm-hmm.
But then what other factors are happening that make it harder to implement or harder to have public safety? So I think we'll have that continued discussion here. But what it did do, and I'm grateful for this, it caused a place for people to focus their voice.
Yes.
And for that, I'm grateful. In some respect, also, I've taken some of the beating because as being one of the prime movers behind that, I also got some of the prime blame. But so did some of the commission members.
Right.
But what it did do is it highlighted we have a public safety problem. And drugs and alcohol and behavioral health, for the most part, are just kicking the feet out from under us. Mm-hmm. And we just got to do better. And the drugs and alcohol and the thievery that go with that to support that habit are just not acceptable to the public, nor are they to anybody on this committee, I don't think. So
correct. And there's so many players involved in this, and nobody has extra money. And everybody's trying to manage their budget, and everybody's trying to manage their risk through policy. And so we really do have a tough environment right now. Senate Bill 91 did not happen in a vacuum. It happened with all of the challenges that are confronting everybody involved.
One last question, and I want to have Commissioner Stanfield come before us, so please, thank you.
Be real brief, but it's just relating a call that I got from a constituent. And I'm not saying, I can only relate what was said to me through my staff, but my constituent was told that the reason a lady got robbed was because of Senate Bill 91, and that, quote, even if they did catch the guy, they wouldn't be able to arrest him because of Senate Bill 91. So I don't think that's probably accurate.
No. I don't think Senate Bill caused him to go rob somebody.
I'm hearing just a tremendous amount of resistance, concern, probably some of it rightfully so, from the police.
And that's probably a reference to the C felony. Person was here, we wouldn't be able to arrest them. And I've heard officers express that frustration. And I've asked them, well, who was the suspect? Because it has to be a first-time C felony. And they're like, well, we don't know who the suspect is. So you actually don't know if it would be a first-time C felony for that person or not.
But if I could, and I think the point I want to make real quick, and I know we have to move on, is we've got to figure out a way to communicate with the police about what the bill actually does, and we've got to figure out a way, if there are problems, I want to address those problems head on. I don't want to duck them.
And it can be very difficult, and people across the state are in different environments. Take the bail schedule, which has caused a lot of concern, and it's caused concern in Juneau. But as we heard the commission meeting, it causes a great deal more concern in Anchorage, where officers testified that even when they would call because they felt like someone was dangerous, the magistrates wouldn't approve any bail. And that then they quit calling. And so it just became, no visible enforcement. And so we have a lot of players here, but I agree that we need to improve that communication. And also boil down to, okay, what exactly caused that particular assessment?
The other thing that I think we need to keep in mind is that the municipality of Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, North Pole, all have police forces that enforce misdemeanors, and the rest is enforced by the state. And so that is its own tension in itself on prosecution capacity and resources available for that prosecution. So, and we'll talk a little bit about that because I think that's part of the dynamic we have to kind of keep in front of us as policymakers to make sure that when we are looking at something to fix, if you will, or something to make better, that we keep that kind of context in mind because we don't want to shift things to the communities if they don't have the resources. We also want to make sure that people are held accountable with both state and municipal resources to the best of our ability. So
absolutely.
And so that's another thing in tension that we have to deal with.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, committee members, for very, very much for your questions. Let's have Brandon Stanfill, who is also one of the advocates that comes from the victim advocacy group, and who's been on the commission from the start. And she is somebody that I've worked very closely with in Fairbanks with some of the safe havens for women for the most part. And Brenda, put yourself on record and give us your testimony.
Brenda Stanfill, and I am with the commission, Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, and also the executive director of the Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living and a member of the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. So I would also echo that I came to this work not exactly sure what I signed on for, but knew that after 21 years working in social services, I felt that I was treading water and my head was still almost above, but we weren't making progress. And just trying to figure out what do we do? We've been serving victims, we've been helping victims, we've been getting them back on their feet. We've been, and then in my database, I'd look and I'd say, wait, John Smith, oh, new victim. Another year goes, oh, wait, John Smith, new victim. But where's our work on the side of the person who's harming our community? What are we doing on that side? And we'd look, so I came down here and I sat before you all and I said, we need felonies. We need to go forward. We need to put them in jail. We need longer jail terms. We need to make sure that folks know this is not okay. And we did that. We increased. We got where, you know, two domestic violence and it turns into a felony and we can do a higher level of prosecution. Thefts did the same thing. As the more thefts you do, you get more time, all of these things. And it didn't change anything. In fact, as we've just heard, you know, uptick 2-3 years ago in crime started happening. Well, the same time that uptick in crime, we had our closing systems. We had a mental health system in Fairbanks that went totally bankrupt. No mental health services. Assisted living homes that closed. Our treatment beds, almost non-existent at one point in time. 8 treatment beds in all of Fairbanks and around the state. They were experiencing the same kind of things. Opioids, heroin, resurgence back, you know, for the first 15, 16 years I operated our shelter, I did not find a needle in my shelter. At this point in time, it's very common to clean out a room and find needles for people who are addicted to things that involve injections. And detox that is very hard to access. Chronic inebriates who are using our jails as a homeless shelter. One of the things I said during the Criminal Justice Commission meeting is, wait a minute, if you do OR, does that mean they can't stay? And they said, yeah, no, that means, and I said, wait, they want to stay. And a comment was made, nobody wants to stay in jail. And it's like, no, it's 50 below. They want to stay in jail. I had a detective stop by my office not too long ago and said, Brenda, a few of us have gotten punched in the face now once they realize they're not going to go to jail for what they stole. You know, so thanks. You know, you've increased my danger. And we have to be aware that when you have no resources for where you can go when it's 50 below and you're cold and you're drunk, you're going to do something to get in jail because that's the only place safe for you to go right then. And so, you know, the statement was made, we cannot criminalize our way out of social issues. I wish I remembered who made that statement because I would give them credit because I have embraced that. We can't criminalize our way out of social issues. So here's the part about this process. You've heard a lot about this process from others, so I won't go into that. But here's the part about this process that excites me. What excites me is if we can get to the point of addressing the underlying problem with programs. One of the things that happened last year with Senate Bill 91 is that there was reinvestment dollars put into certain things that we are starting to see the results of. There was funding put into prevention. We're starting to see those prevention programs that are going to be standing up, and they've gotten some funding. They're finding staffing. They're going to be offering things like coaching boys to men. My heart broke when I read the name of the young man who was shot by troopers after shooting at troopers in North Pole. I knew that little guy, and I'm sorry, I still get a little bit emotional on that. I knew that little guy from my shelter, and I didn't do what I should have done for him. I didn't have any services for kids. Oh, I do apologize. I usually do this. But I didn't have anything at the time. And as he got older and he got into the criminal justice system, we all saw it. And we said, when did he move from victim to offender? When did that happen? And what could we have done? And then he's dead, and we had no more opportunity to do anything. And I want to get ahead of this. Coaching boys and men, you can start bringing in coaches that can learn and engage and work with young men who don't have a mentor. Chris McLean, who was working with Circle Sentencing, he's now our reentry coordinator in Fairbanks. And I said, he was telling me his history, and he told me I could use him. So he told me his history, and I said, Chris, what made a difference for you? Because he was surrounded by some things that you wouldn't have thought he would end up a magistrate. And he said, and he started tracking back, and he said, three people mentored me. Three people came into my life at a pivotal point and said, we believe in you. And it had to do with sports. You know, so how do we bring this into young men's lives, into young girls' lives? How do we build these empowerment programs? How do we get to that point? It's not going to happen by spending just the $150 a day in a jail bed. How can we get them to a treatment program who could teach them what they need to know, who could address the trauma that they're using the alcohol and the drugs to numb because they can't face the sexual assault that happened to them? And both young men and young women, the sexual assault and the abuse that happens to them as children leads to this trauma that we're facing. So this is the exciting part to me about Senate Bill 91. I understand the frustrations as the person sitting in the victim advocate seat. I've heard a lot from victims about you didn't do the right thing. I'm sleeping okay at night because I think we did do the right thing. Because if we put them in jail, young man just spent 9 months in jail, meth addicted. 9 months in jail, he did not get one thing of treatment. He moved three different jails, and because of that, he couldn't stay in one jail long enough to finish it. He didn't get any treatment. He came out onto the streets. He tried. But within a month, he connected back with the same people. He was without a home to live in when he got out. He didn't have any services. These are the things we've got to wrap people in if we expect success. We've got to do the reentry. We've got to get people case managed before. We've got to get the internal POs and the external POs connected where they've got that plan. And here's the thing about those C felonies. I understand that there's no jail time, but they actually have a probation officer. And there's a much different thing between probation officer who's actually seeing what you're doing and that court supervised probation, which really means there's nobody overseeing you. It's just, and so I know that those C felonies, the thought process was, you know, if they want to just do the jail time, here's a misdemeanor, plead to a misdemeanor, but if you want the no jail time, you're going to have some kind of supervision. And we may have missed it on that, and I'm more than willing to go back and take a look and see if there's something we could do, but we really did have a thinking behind all of those things, and I'm still confused as to why law enforcement thinks they can't arrest, but I'll learn more about that, I'm sure, as this goes on. So I'm really excited about the work that we're continuing to do. I had all kinds of numbers for you here, but I didn't do anything on them. So I hope that that's okay. But I do think that as the person representing victims, we need to really focus on restitution. You've got some information that has come to you, and I hope you'll read that report. There's some good recommendations. One of the things is to help with some kind of bridge funding. You know, when your car gets stolen and you still have to come up with that $500 deductible or that $1,000 deductible, sometimes it's hard to get a new vehicle. You know, how can we help people who've been victimized in these property crime areas to make sure that they're still able to function in life and that we can find ways to get people to pay their restitution in a more expedient way? And all of those things. So you'll find that in the report and would be happy. I know you're almost out of time, so.
We're down to the last 7 minutes. But first of all, thank you for the work that you've done on the commission. You brought a pretty valuable voice, as every participant has, but you've been very active, and I appreciate that. And it is true that quite often victims are the people who are without voice, because the people who get charged at least get counsel. They get time to think about it. They get resources, minimal as they are, at least they have resources. Most victims are without resources, and they're just left empty, violated, and without any help. And I think as we have tried to address that, we probably could do better. And certainly restitution is one big part. And it's been a lingering question to the whole state for a long time. And there's two sides to that question. Do the restitution problem go to the state for the cost of prosecuting, or does the restitution go to the victim for the harm caused? And I think the answer is yes to both. Then it's a matter of how do we make that division of effort. And then what we tried to address in Senate Bill 91 was the ability for somebody to be productive enough to earn enough money to pay restitution. Quite often right now what we've done is we've sequestered them out of the productive part of society and expect them to produce something, and it's been very, very difficult. So I think that's been one of the more successful elements of this. But it is true that people are so tired of being victimized. They're just so tired of it. And many of them, like you said, have turned to the criminal element. But what we're concerned about is now people who won't turn to criminal element being vigilantes and being the criminals now. And I think that's something that we have to kind of keep in mind as we move forward, is we want justice to be quick enough so that people don't feel like they have to take it into their own hands. And that's going to be something we have to work on, I think, here in this committee. Is there any questions for Brenda at this point? Thanks for coming to Juneau. Thanks for your work. Thank you, commission members, for being present with us. I'm going to talk a little bit about where we go from here. There are two elements that were brought up today that that we need to talk about, and that is implementation and some of those places where implementation has been tough. So I'm going to have the court system come before us, mainly because the issue of the bail and the released on your own recognizance is outside of Senate Bill 91, but in the target area of what we're talking about. And so I think we need to have an understanding of how the court system sees it, maybe what we could do to work with them. I think that's an area. Implementation with the Department of Corrections. I think we asked the Department of Corrections to change our culture so significantly. We need to find out from them what's happening. And the implementation timelines, I think, is some of the things that were brought up today are going to be very, very important. But let me reassure both the members in front of me as committee members, the commission members, and the society who is watching us, we're as interested in public safety as anybody is. So getting the right resources, getting the right policy calls, and right now we have about three things floating up that we're just going to have to deal with, and that is what I think I've heard pejoratively called catch and release, and that is we send a policeman out to do a job, they go out, they catch a bad actor, and he's on the street or she's on the street within hours. That's not acceptable to society. And it's not something I think we're going to accept here as a commission or as a committee, I mean. So public safety is going to be paramount. But we do have resource issues. As Chrisell said, the budget is heading down into harder and difficult, more crunch time. So the resources are not going to be lavish. So we need to make sure that our prioritization is best we can make it for public safety. And I'll try to make sure that we manage that conversation as best we can here so that if there's an uptick in crime, whether it be at the theft level to support a drug habit or at the most egregious level of somebody taking somebody else's life, that the resources can go to take care of those who need to be defended, those who need to be prosecuted, those who need to be jailed, but those who, through some effort on our part, can turn to a more productive life. And all of those, as Suzanne DiPietro said, are some work in tandem, some work in tension. And we'll try to figure out how to balance some of those things. So my hat's off to the public safety officers, to the public that have to, the people who jail them, they don't get to pick who shows up. The court who has to deal with them, they don't get to pick who shows up. The police have to go actually pick them up. And our policy committee is really interested in how to help you make it work better. So the Judiciary Committee at this point will adjourn today with the view that we're going to start talking about implementation and then reinvestment. What are some of the issues we're going to deal with reinvestment and some of the timelines involved in that. Any other comments from the Commission at this point? Obviously, we've got some things that we need to work on, but obviously there's some things working. So thank you for those who make it work. Department of Law, thank you. I know that we have a resource issue. Public Safety Commissioners here, for every policeman, whether at the community level, Chriselle, or the state level. We appreciate and want to work with you. So we're going to try and find some solutions along the way. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.